inflation, an IPO, and some space junk for fun. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday, October 15th. Good to have you with us. The Fed meets later this month, in part to determine whether the economy is finally strong enough to raise interest rates or not. Part of the data they're looking at came out today. Consumer prices, the prices we pay for what the Bureau of Labor Statistics calls a representative basket of goods and services. And those prices for the past 12 months have been basically flat. In other words, we're not seeing much inflation out there. And the Fed wants more of it, the magic number of 2%. We called up Laura Veldkamp. She's an associate professor of economics at NYU Stern School of Business. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So inflation for consumers can be uncomfortable. We like to know the price of things. Why is a positive inflation rate actually good for the economy?
Because the alternative is worse. So we don't like to see prices changing. We don't like prices at the store changing. We certainly don't like prices on our wages changing. But the alternative is that quantities change. So the economy is like this system that absorbs shocks. And either prices move when a shock hits the economy, or quantities move when a shock hits the economy. What are these quantities I'm talking about? These are like the numbers of firms or the numbers of workers. So if we don't make little adjustments in prices that help the economy to adjust to these shocks, instead what we'll see is firms going bankrupt and people losing their jobs.
And why is 2% the magic number? Why is that the inflation rate the Fed shoots for?
Well, we don't want inflation to get too high, because if we're very high, then, well, it does get costly to think, well, how much does this really cost? And what should I expect it to cost? And how much did it cost last year? And we'd have to reprint menus, and we'd have to redo subway pricing and, you know, Coca-Cola machines. We'd have to put different numbers of coins in there. All that retuning does cost something. So 2%, I think, has become a common wisdom compromise between putting enough grease in the wheels of the economy so that prices can do some adjusting and avoiding deflation, which is really bad.
If the Fed is able to achieve this 2% inflation rate, what's it mean if wages don't match that or don't go up with that?
Well, that means that people's wages won't be able to keep up with the cost of the bundles of goods that they're consuming. So they're going to start to feel poorer. On the other hand, that's going to make workers cheaper to firms, because workers will seem less expensive to them than, say, buying new machinery to, hiring somebody to check out your goods will look relatively cheap rather than buying a machine that will do the checkout for you. And so that could lead to a surge in employment. So if you're out of a job, you should be happy if the wages stay pretty low, because it makes it more likely that somebody's going to want to hire you. If you already have a job and you're likely to keep it, well, then this is bad news for you, because it means that you're going to have less ability to purchase the goods and services you were buying before.
When you look at the broader economic picture in the U.S., what do you see?
I think there's a lot of uncertainty right now. I think we could see, with good management and fiscal prudence and with a little help from our friends and neighbors around the world and good policy on their part, we could see a resurgence of growth. The U.S. economy is below the trend level of output that it should have been pre-financial crisis. So we've got some slack in the system, and we could mobilize more people back into the labor force and rejuvenate investment and really have a surge of economic activity in the future. But that's a lot of ifs. Things need to go well. And I think a lot of people are still hesitant to reinvest and to start new businesses, because it does seem like kind of an uncertain, risky time. We saw some pretty extraordinary stuff in the financial markets a few years ago, and I think that spooked a lot of people. That fear, that uncertainty is restraining a lot of activity.
Laura Veldkamp is Associate Professor of Economics at NYU Stern School of Business. Thanks so much.
Sure.
On Wall Street today, up as if carried by balloons. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The federal investigators are sniffing around drug maker Valeant. It's a company that's taken some heat recently for aggressively raising the prices of its drugs. Feds are looking into those pricing practices and the company's patient assistance programs. A lot of big pharma companies have these programs, which help uninsured or low-income patients afford expensive prescriptions. But the programs are controversial. Some experts blame them for keeping drug prices high at great cost to consumers and taxpayers. Marketplace's Annie Baxter reports.
Pharmaceutical firms use patient assistance programs to get at problems like this.
Drug companies know that if patients have to pay a lot of money out of their own pocket for their products, then fewer patients will take the drugs.
David Howard is a health policy expert at Emory University. He says drug companies can directly help patients with prescription costs, except if the patients are on a government insurance program, like Medicare. In that case, Howard says patients can get help through foundations, which the drug companies may give money to.
The restriction is that the foundations can't steer patients to a particular drug.
In the best case scenario, patients can afford life-saving prescriptions. But critics say patient assistance programs may steer people to costlier drugs. Steve Schondelmeyer is a professor of pharmaceutical economics at the University of Minnesota.
There may be a drug available that costs $50 or $100 that is the safest, most effective drug that you should be on.
But he says these patient assistance programs might say, hey, with our help, you could instead take the drug that's $500 or $1,000 and have no out-of-pocket costs. Schondelmeyer says employers or government programs then have to foot that extra cost.
And next year, the premiums will go up, and you will either pay for that as an employee or in taxes.
How big a role do patient assistance programs play in driving up drug costs? Schondelmeyer says that's hard to tell. A lot of the information on the programs is proprietary. But he says they do merit investigation, considering that prices for brand name and specialty drugs are going up 10 to 12% a year. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
The oil industry hub of Cushing, Oklahoma is on high alert right now for an earthquake. The entire Sooner State is on track for 900 quakes this year. Many are believed to be linked to oil and gas production. Cushing is home to one of the largest oil storage facilities anywhere and a key pipeline for the oil industry. On Saturday, it had a 4.5 magnitude quake. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
The earth shook in Cushing Saturday night, right after a government report found nearby geologic faults had awakened, they'd reactivated. The paper links recent earthquakes in Cushing to underground injections of wastewater from drilling and fracking. So, do injections explain the latest quake?
Most likely it does.
Dan McNamara of the National Earthquake Information Center co-wrote the paper.
There are numerous studies in Oklahoma that show a strong connection between wastewater injection and seismicity, so I would not be surprised if the same thing is true in the Cushing region.
A region with 8,000 people and 53 million barrels of oil. It's the nation's crossroads for crude, says Jake Dollarhide of Longbow Asset Management in Tulsa.
Its centralized location in the United States and its vast pipeline system to the Gulf led it to be the critical entry point for crude.
Cushing can hold as much oil as the planet burns in a day. So if anything goes wrong, a terror attack, an earthquake, Dollarhide says it's as crucial a choke point as the Suez Canal or the Strait of Hormuz. Any day now, regulators at the Oklahoma Corporation Commission will issue new limits on water injection. Spokesman Matt Skinner says even before Saturday, they had forced 6 injection wells to shut down or slow down.
Obviously, we're going farther afield, and we're looking at what else is in the area, what are the options available to us.
All this is new to Oklahoma. In 2008, it had 2 earthquakes. Last year, 584. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
You might know Square for that little white cube merchants use to swipe your credit card. The financial services company is headed up by CEO Jack Dorsey, who's also the CEO of Twitter. Square has officially filed to go public, which gives us a glimpse of some of the company's inner workings. Marketplace's Molly Wood is with us now. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Adrian.
Why is Square planning an IPO now?
I have to say that is a fraught question. It is not a great market for IPOs, and tech IPOs over the past few months haven't done as well as I'm sure their founders and CEOs and shareholders would have hoped. But I think there's some interesting timing at play here. You know, Jack Dorsey just basically caved in to the pressure and took over as Twitter CEO. And it's possible, especially given some of the financial turmoil at Square, that the company thought this is a good time to raise this money, raise this capital, double down on the business, and get the IPO off of Jack's plate.
I want to ask you about that turmoil at Square. How healthy is the company right now?
You know, it's losing money. There's no question about that. So far in 2015, Square's lost about $77 million. And there is not a clear path to profitability. So they have a great valuation and investors seem pretty confident. But, you know, just as recently as this time last year, there were discussions that Square might be looking to sell itself, that the financial situation had gotten that bad. They've definitely renegotiated some deals. They're trying to put themselves in a better position. But I would say that it is far from a slam dunk.
We also found out they've lost the deal they had with Starbucks. How significant is that?
You know, that's a really interesting story because on the one hand, Starbucks is one of Square's largest customers. But on the other hand, it sounds like Square lost a lot of money on that deal. By some accounts, they lost $56 million. And you could argue that that in itself is a sign of poor deal making at Square. But getting out from under that Starbucks deal may turn out to be not the worst of their problems.
What else did we learn about Square from this filing?
Well, we learned that Square is concerned about Jack Dorsey's time, which is not a surprise. They have a line in the prospectus, though, about the fact that this guy is the CEO of two companies, and there may be times when that adversely affects his ability to take over, to run things, and to really be paying attention. We also learned that they're worried about earthquakes, which is not a surprise. The prospectus
because
is always
they're in
such
the Bay Area,
reading,
right?
Because they're located in the Bay Area. But one thing I think is slightly underreported about Square is that they're very worried about the transition to chip credit cards. You know, we just had that shift in liability in this month in October, and merchants are now liable for any fraud that occurs if they aren't using the new chip credit cards. Now, Square does have readers that can accept those chip cards, but they're charging money for them. The previous readers were free. They gave them out to merchants for free. So they're concerned about liability costs there and also just about fraud in the service generally.
One of my favorite parts of the filing, and we need to talk about this before you go, is that under the potential risks, they said it's possible that Square employees are going to get so unimaginably rich, they're going to leave the company. What is that?
That's the Bay Area talking is what that is. I think so many companies in the Bay Area struggle with that or struggle with losing, you know, employees to companies that might get richer. I think given some of the issues that are facing Square, that might fall more in the wishful thinking category.
Marketplace's Molly Wood, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
It's not just Square that's under pressure from those new chip credit cards. In its third quarter earnings yesterday, Netflix blamed the credit card switchover for disappointing U.S. subscriber numbers. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains.
I'm sure this has happened to you. Your card expires or the number gets stolen and your credit card issuer sends you a new one. And then you have to give that info to all the companies that store it or charge you automatically. The newspaper, the gym you don't actually use, and yeah, your Netflix.
I think I had 3 cards reissued in the past 18 months.
Deborah Baxley, who works in the cards and payments practice at Capgemini, says this is a perennial problem, but it's been magnified by the switch to chip cards.
With so many cards reissued at the same time, it's like a perfect storm.
120 million Americans already have their new chip cards, according to the Smart Card Alliance. That number is supposed to rise to 600 million by year end. Matt Schultz with creditcards.com says people may be getting tired of constantly updating their info.
I definitely think that there could be fatigue because a lot of people have gotten new cards several times over the last few years with all the data breaches and now chip cards.
The changeover may be inconvenient, says Michael Pachter, a research analyst at Wedbush Securities. But is it to blame for Netflix's recent performance?
I titled my note this morning, "The Dog Ate My Homework and Other Excuses."
He says if you really valued the service, you'd suck it up and put in your new info. So if people aren't doing that with Netflix,
that belies a much bigger problem, which is that there probably are a significant number of people who are paying but don't actually use the service.
Like that gym you never visit, maybe another new card is just the excuse you've been looking for to quit. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Coming up?
On the smaller spacecraft at lower orbits, we definitely increase the premium for debris issues.
Insurance for your spaceship. But first, let's do the numbers. And the earnings palooza continues. The Dow Jones Industrial Average picked up 1.25%, or 217 points, to close at 17,141. The Nasdaq added 1.8%, that's 87 points, to close at 4870. And the S&P 500 regained 1.4%, or 29 points. It finished at 2023. Financial shares took it to the bank today. Citigroup climbed more than 4% after reporting a 51% rise in quarterly profits. That rubbed off on Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, and Morgan Stanley. They were all up more than 3%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.01%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Adrienne Hill. Canada's federal election takes place on Monday. Conservative Prime Minister Stephen Harper is in a tight three-way race to keep his current job. And one of the major issues of the campaign there has been Syrian refugees and how many refugees the country should help resettle. Emma Jacobs reports from Montreal.
Refugee!
Just over a week before the election, protesters in downtown Montreal chanted in French, "Refugees, welcome." Mohamed Mahmoud, a Syrian-Canadian activist, addressed the crowd of several hundred demonstrators.
If you can help Syrians, please do. They are nice people.
Mahmoud went on in French to criticize Prime Minister Stephen Harper. At issue, reports Harper's office had delayed the processing of applications for a security audit. Also that his administration was giving priority to Christian refugees. Even advocates didn't expect Syrian refugees to be a high-profile campaign issue. But in September, 3-year-old Alan Kurdi drowned while his family was trying to reach Turkey. Photos of his body washed up on a beach became the iconic image of the Syrian refugee crisis. The boy had an aunt living in British Columbia, Tima Kurdi. She had sent the money for the family to be smuggled out and spoke to reporters outside her home.
It shouldn't happen. It shouldn't happen to them.
Canadians were riveted. Tima Kurdi had hoped to eventually use Canada's private refugee sponsorship program to bring over her relatives. That program allows citizens to raise the money to resettle refugees over and above the government's commitments. Janet Dench, executive director of the Canadian Council for Refugees, says the little boy's death made Canadians look more closely at their nation's practices. And she says even with changes since Kurdi's death, the private sponsorship program is still full of red tape.
I've talked to private sponsors who say that it takes them up to 6 months to prepare an application because it is so complicated.
The Canadian government has promised to take in 10,000 Syrian refugees over 4 years. The latest development, Canadians learned the Prime Minister's staff halted the processing of some Syrian refugees last spring for a security audit. Harper's office also instructed immigration to prioritize Christians and other religious minorities, even though most Syrian refugees are Sunni Muslims. Harper responded to these reports at a recent campaign event.
Our government has adopted a generous approach to the admission of refugees while ensuring the selection of the most vulnerable people and keeping our country safe and secure.
His conservative base has been supportive of this view. Polls show Canadians generally split on how many refugees to accept. But Harper's rivals apparently think this issue will work to their advantage. Liberal candidate Justin Trudeau, the son of former Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau, is Harper's closest rival going into the election. Here's what he told the CBC about the way Harper's administration has handled the refugee issue.
That's not the Canada we want. That's not the Canada we need to build.
Though Harper's conservative on immigration, he's counted on significant support among new immigrants in the past. His party won 42% of the votes of foreign-born Canadians in 2011, a higher percentage than he received from those born in Canada. In Montreal, I'm Emma Jacobs for Marketplace.
We have a bit of a space junk problem. Human-made trash, large and small, just hurtling around up there. The junk poses a risk to satellites and the International Space Station, but it could also present a business opportunity. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has our story.
Worst-case scenario when it comes to space junk is that it would hit something with people in it. Marketplace's budget for space travel is a bit limited this quarter, so we'll use the example of the movie Gravity.
Debris is from a BSC set.
What's much more likely to happen is that a crash in space would cost money, not lives. Satellites are expensive, and just like cars that are at risk of accidents, satellites have insurance.
On the smaller spacecraft at lower orbits, we definitely increase the premium for debris issues.
Richard Parker is managing director of Assure Space. He says, as far as he knows, the insurance industry hasn't paid out any claims for a debris accident, so they aren't too worried about it. But when it does happen...
And so I would think, you know, in the next 5 years...
Rates will probably go up pretty quickly, because unlike car accidents, in space, it's really hard to prove fault and get people to pay up.
And I doubt whether the launching country is going to stand up and say... Please, Mr. Insurer, I'd like to repay you all the money you've just paid out.
The insurance costs between 5 and 15% of the satellite's value, and satellites can be worth hundreds of millions of dollars. To prevent expensive accidents, the focus now is on tracking the debris. It's kind of like this.
Heading over to the northwest side, a couple crashes that are actually causing some big delays this morning, so listen up if you're driving around.
Your morning traffic report. If you know it's congested somewhere, you can take a different route. But since traffic helicopters don't really work so well in space, we have to rely on radar. Right now, the Air Force tracks about 23,000 orbiting space objects, including debris. Last year, Lockheed Martin won a $915 million contract to build a new tracking system.
So it will allow the U.S. Air Force to see much smaller objects, and it also has a much higher capacity.
Lockheed Steve Bruce says the system will be able to monitor hundreds of thousands of pieces of space junk. Plus, the technology has other uses as well.
So you could use it for detecting aircraft. You could use it for detecting weather. So we'll continue to expand our business in those domains.
Other companies want to track space junk in space. Alvin Alexander runs Orion Applied Science and Technology.
Our plan is to have a ground-based architecture, but it'll be complemented with a space-based architecture as well.
From there, Alexander says they could potentially track millions of pieces of space junk, even the tiny bits. Down the road, the company wants to tackle the very difficult and very expensive process of removing some of the debris. He says it's important to start before there are more accidents.
It's not so common as of right now. However, all of the trends indicate that it's growing progressively worse. And how bad does bad need to get before we define a solution?
Alexander and others warn that if we ignore the problem, vital communication and national security infrastructure could be at risk. But it's worth noting, all these guys do make money off of that risk. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
This last note on the way out today, a story Kai sent over this morning, along with the note, this week's sign of the apocalypse. Kai knows I like apocalyptic signs. So you may have heard of ETFs, exchange-traded funds. Bloomberg is reporting there's an ETF in the works that'll trade on social media sentiment. Not social media stocks, mind you, but companies that are being talked about on social media. The fund will reportedly hold the 25 most tweeted about stocks and use an algorithm to decide whether to buy or short a specific company based on what people are tweeting. How could that possibly go wrong? Today, the Dow picked up 1.25% or 217 points. The Nasdaq added 1.8%. That's 87 points. And the S&P 500 regained 1.4% or 29 points. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Adrienne Hill. Kai's going to be back tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.